modern people, it seems to me that a chair, a person should have a chair. That only seems to make sense. And we are, in fact, reflecting on the Middle Eastern approach to things. And so in our Middle Eastern tradition, the teacher has a chance to sit. If you would recall the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus begins by going up the mountain, then he sits and begins to teach them. Please, there are no presuppositions here. And also when he enters the synagogue in Luke 4, he stands up to read and he sits down to teach. Now, we're in the West. We've got this ridiculous idea that the poor fellow doing all the work has to stand up and everybody else gets to relax. I'm not sure. But here we're starting now a new tradition. I'm also very happy to be among you here because our own people came from Northern Ireland and settled all in one place a couple of hundred years ago in Pittsburgh and the surrounding area. So Pittsburgh is known for plate glass, pickles, paint, pig iron, and Presbyterians in that order. And so there are far more Presbyterians in Western Pennsylvania than you have Mennonites here in this district. And what we say about ourselves, I'm sure, is not true about you. What we say is that Presbyterians are denser in Western Pennsylvania. So it's very happy to be a place where there is a community that has come to one place and preserved their tradition across the years in their new home. Now, our series this week is really working at a single question. And that is, when Jesus, after he asks the disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" And we're all familiar with the answer. Peter finally says, "You are the Christ," or "You are the Christ of God," or "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," whichever version you read. And then Jesus immediately begins to explain that he is on his way to the cross and that he will be killed, and on the third day he rises from the dead, identifying himself as the Son of Man. And Peter gets upset. No, this can't happen. Now, after Peter gets upset, Jesus then gets upset with Peter. Now, our question is Jesus' disturbance, anger, disappointment with Peter valid? Is there, in what he did and what he had to say, an interpretation of the nature and meaning of his cross that the disciples could have understood? Now, I know the text says again and again that they didn't understand. But could they? Was it available? Now, if it was not available to them, if he really never did interpret his cross, if all he said was it's going to happen, and then they get upset, his being angry with Peter is quite unfair. And so this is the basic question that we are going to examine. Was the criticism of Peter on that occasion valid? Now, to do this, we have to do two things. One is we have to see Jesus as a theologian. And second, we have to, more essentially today, we have to look at the methodology which he used in order that his theology might be preserved for the people of Palestine in his day and more largely for the church universal. Now, we ordinarily do not think of Jesus as a theologian. If you would run through your mind just all the sermons that you've heard across the centuries, however long and however old you have to be, all the sermons that you've read that are across the centuries, generally speaking, we turn to Paul for our theology, and we then turn to Jesus for an ethical example. And so Jesus comes out as the Son of God, the Savior of the world, the perfect example of the ethical life which we are expected to live, the perfect demonstration of love. But when we think of theologian, we think of Paul. We think perhaps of John. We turn to Luke. We talk about Matthew. We don't think, generally speaking, of Jesus. Now why? We'll talk more about this in our series, but I think this is because we have defined theology in systematic terms, or in logical terms, or in philosophical terms, or in abstract terms. From the heritage of the Greeks, 5th century BC, we have decided that theology should be carefully structured along a particular logical system or philosophical system, and so one can trace the various movements of theology across the centuries and see that the systematicians have always, and for this we are grateful, used the philosophical mood of the day as a climate within which they communicate the truth of the gospel. And that's fine. Without such people, great things would have always been lost. So in the age of Platonism, the fabric of systematic theology is Platonism. In the High Middle Ages with Thomas Aquinas, the fabric of systematic theology becomes Aristotelianism. And in the Reformation, it's Scholasticism. And in 19th century, it becomes Hegelianism. Early 20th century, it's existentialism. And now, systematicians are talking about process theology, in which we do our theology within the framework of the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead. All of this is fine. Our systematicians are thereby evangelists, reaching out to a world with a particular mindset and trying to use that mindset as a bridge to proclaim the gospel, and we are grateful to them. But there's another kind of theology, and this is the theology of the metaphorical theology. And so our question becomes, does theology have to be in abstractions, or can it be in concrete pictures and dramatic actions? And if theology is done in concrete pictures and dramatic actions, are these concrete pictures and dramatic actions illustrations of abstractions? Do they illustrate meaning? And my answer is no, they do not illustrate meaning, they create. That when we learn from the scripture that the believer is born of God, we have a metaphor. And in that metaphor, there is something physical and something spiritual hung together in a unique tension. And so we can rationally and systematically extract from it a series of principles. This means 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and that's fine. We are in the West, inheritors of the Greeks. We do our thinking in abstract terms, in rational terms, in structural terms, we always probably will. And so that's fine when we go at it that way. But when we get done, here is the metaphor, here is the series of abstractions, which we like the squeezing of the orange, we've got this juice out of it. Now our question is, what has the deeper level impact on the person who hears that metaphor? Is it the abstractions, or is it the metaphor itself? Is it the juice squeezed out of the orange, or is it the whole orange itself? I would submit to you that the orange itself speaks to us on a deeper level. The metaphor has rational, corrupt, rational content within it. We are bodies and souls hung together in a unique tension, and as bodies and souls hung together, mind and physical support of that mind and body, that we are not machines that think, we are bodies that think, and thereby the theologian who touches us on these levels touches us on a very deep level indeed. And I hope by the time we get done these four lectures, you will have entertained the thought that the first theologian of the New Testament is Jesus of Nazareth and not Paul of Tarsus. Now, as the foundational lecture which we must give this morning, as a basis for everything else we're going to say, without which we don't have any place to stay, is how did Jesus and the disciples pass on the material that we have in the Gospels? We must discuss the period of oral tradition and the nature of the transmission through that period. People say, well, Jesus never wrote a book. I think that's not fair. It's true, he didn't compose and write a book. But if you are living in an oral tradition community, the writing of a book is a waste of time. Who's going to read it? Very few intelligentsia at the top might read it. But if you are anxious to reach out to the grassroots of the people around you, you will use the transmission methodology that they are familiar with. Here we've got it, okay. 20th century transmission methodology is all of these bits and pieces of electronics. I used to worry about how the kingdom of God ever got going without a mimeograph machine. And now I've got to worry about how on earth they ever got going without videotapes and I don't know what else. But one need not get upset over these things. We are merely using the transmission methodology that is the methodology familiar to the community in the age in which we live. And so when you ask, did Jesus write a book, you are really asking, was he interested in the preservation and transmission of what he had to say? And if so, did he use the methodology of the people to whom he was anxious, to communicate, and who he was anxious to have received and then pass on the material that he gave to them? If he did, then it's unfair to say he never wrote a book. All right? We're back now to our question of, did he in fact do that, and what was his methodology? Now, the methodology was the use of the oral transmission. And there has been, as I'm sure you're familiar, if you are familiar with the technical New Testament studies, in the past 200 years, a roaring debate over this question. And so we wish to walk in where angels fear to tread and try to see if we can find a place to stand out of which we can affirm that Jesus was a theologian and that he had his own theological thoughts that he wanted people to remember. And this will come out of our own experience in the Middle East. Now, when we are at work in the Middle East, it's been my privilege to deal with two different kinds of material. Oh, by the way, our topic, as we have defined it, is informal, controlled oral tradition. This is what we are going to try and describe. That will give us a foundation for what we have to say the rest of our series. In the Middle East, we have, generally speaking, two sources. One source is the written material, which we find in manuscript form in monasteries. There is one monastery 20 miles away from Beirut that has 2,500 unread Arabic Christian manuscripts. People find out that I'm an Arabicist. They say, oh, is your field Islamics, or are you interested in Middle Eastern studies? I say, no. No, I'm interested in Arabic Christian literature. The jaw falls somewhere down around the belt. They've never heard of things of this kind. For indeed, we have from the 9th to the 13th century tremendous flowering of Arabic Christian scholarship in all areas of Christian theology, and we are at work trying to uncover and trying to study a slice of those which are the material in the New Testament. In typical German fashion, we have a German who has given us a catalog of all five thick volumes, and so at least we know where we're going, although nobody has read the stuff. Now, when we talk about written materials, fine, what about oral materials? A friend of mine, who is a German lady and is in the archaeology department of the American University, last summer did a dig at a place called Basra al-Sham in the Hauran district of southern Syria. They were excavating the Middle Bronze Age of the Old Testament, 1700 to 1800 BC, and they were uncovering stuff that they couldn't figure out in the construction of Middle Bronze Age houses. When the diggers saw soil that they couldn't figure out what they were seeing, they said, come with us. They took them to the other side of the village to watch the construction of a new home, and sure enough, there were the same methods being used. Yes, now they could understand what the Middle Bronze Age was doing, because of course the villagers are still constructing their homes in the same way. Now, fortunately, the people involved were from Beirut, with an archaeology department of 115 years of history behind them in the Middle East. They were emotionally and intellectually prepared to discover the answers to their Bronze Age questions in observing traditional patterns of construction in the modern village. Now, I had a similar experience. A few years ago, I had in class a young man whose name was Yusuf Mahdi from Iraq. He started off as a monk in a Syriac Orthodox in northern Iraq. They take them in as young boys. And he had spent 11 years in the monastery, came to a very Luther-like evangelical experience, and left the monastery. But of those 11 years, 7 of them, we will discover he was engaged in a very special task. I was lecturing on the problem of the transmission of the written text and the various types of errors that creep in because the copyist didn't always copy stuff right. When I got done, Yusuf sort of laid his pen down with a very fancy flair and a very quiet flair. He said, Dr. Daly, you have not discussed my major problem. What do you mean, Yusuf? He said, well, I spent 7 years in the scriptorium. Oh. Well, tell us about it. So he had 7 years copying manuscripts in the scriptorium. He said, you've talked about many of my problems, but you didn't discuss the flies. He said, yes, I didn't. You mean the flies make fly droppings on the page? No. He said, we have a very hard, polished paper that we use, and the ink is an old formula, centuries old, that we make the ink ourselves and to cure it for 6 months before we start using it. It's a bit thick. In Syriac, the plurals are made with dots. So he said, I will finish a page, put it in the sun to dry, and the ink, the fly would come along and drink my dots, and all of a sudden my plurals had become singulars. And I had to check the page very, very carefully before I turned it into the head of the monastery, lest bits and pieces of the letters would disappear thanks to the thirsty flies whom you never mentioned. Well, I certainly did, because I never heard of it. And to our amazement, here was the classical methodology, and here was someone in the contemporary age who had actually engaged in it, and he could talk to us, yes, entire back. He said he always corrected the grammar of his exemplar, many of the things that we've been talking about, he could tell us about. He could also tell us things we didn't know. And so through Mr. Matty, we could discuss a classical form of tradition preservation that had survived to the present. Now, in a sense, Yusuf Matty is an illustration of what we're trying to do in this lecture today. We're going to talk about a classical method of preservation of traditional materials that we find still very much alive among us. Now, what if we mentioned the fact that we call this informal, controlled oral tradition. We're going to try and find middle ground between what we see to be two extremes. And the two extremes are basically the two views that are currently being championed in international New Testament scholarship. One is the Bookmanian view, which we will call informal, uncontrolled oral tradition, which could also be called rumor transmission. And the other is the formal, controlled oral tradition of the Scandinavian school. They think that Jesus was a rabbi, that he taught his students like a rabbi, and so thereby he passed on to them great massive blocks of memorized data, word by word. And so we're going to see if there is some middle ground between these that is more appropriate to the way Middle Easterners, in fact, pass on the things that are important to them. Now, first of all, let's look at these two views. The Bulmanian view is perhaps familiar to you. This can be summarized in his book, Jesus and the Word, where he writes, I do indeed think that we can now know almost nothing concerning the life and personality of Jesus. Since the early Christian sources show no interest in either, are moreover fragmentary and often legendary, and other sources about Jesus do not exist. If you're familiar with this view, you know what we're talking about. Bulpon says we really know nothing about Jesus except the fact that there was such a man, and he probably died on the cross. And so the information we have is ideas that come out of the id, as it were, of the early Christian community, and which he says what sources offer us is the message of the early Christian community, which for the most part the church freely attributed to Jesus. The material is uncontrolled because he says they were not interested in its preservation. And it is informal in that there is no teacher and no student, no structure within which the material is passed on. According to Bulmann, the material is all fluid and plastic, open to new additions and new shapes, and this view offers us a complex of ideas from Palestine, ideas created mostly by the community to meet its needs. However, this view is not the only view currently argued. The Bulmanian view would tell us the historical Jesus is lost, and if you're interested in finding it, then you don't understand what the faith is all about, because that's to rely on history and not to make the radical step of faith that faith requires of us. Now, in sharp contrast with this is the second currently argued view of two very well-known Scandinavian scholars, Reisenfeld and Gerhardsen. And these two scholars have created a school up there in Scandinavia, and they say no, that in the words of Reisenfeld, quote, the words and deeds of Jesus are a holy word comparable with that of the Old Testament, and the handing down of this precious material is entrusted to special people. In two long, very carefully argued volumes, one entitled Memory and Manuscript, and the second one, Tradition and Transmission in Early Christianity, they go through all the bits and pieces of how the rabbis passed on what was important to them, the techniques of memory, the establishment of schools, the use of notebooks, and then these two scholars try and trace the fact that they feel this is what they see in the New Testament. That Jesus set up, as it were, a rabbinic school, that he had the people memorize stuff, that they probably wrote bits and pieces of it down in notebooks, even during his lifetime. And so Gerhardsen says, when the evangelists edited their gospels, they worked on the basis of a fixed, distinct tradition from and about Jesus, a tradition which was partly memorized and partly written down in notebooks and private scrolls, but invariably isolated from the teachings of other doctrinal authorities. This I call formal, controlled oral tradition. The complete opposite of the Wolfonian view. It's formal in that there is a recognized teacher and a recognized student. It is controlled in that the stuff is passed on word for word from the teacher to the student. No nonsense about it. Those who have studied the Scandinavian schools, such as D.W. Davies, say, fine, there's a lot to be learned there. We must grant to the disciples of Jesus the fact that they probably were as interested in preserving the sayings of their teacher as the students of a rabbi with the teacher of a rabbi. This he feels they have to grant. But he says, because the material was set in the pattern of the context of the Old Testament, and because there is the fact of the presence of the Spirit in the community, as D.W. Davies writes, the words in set in the light of the Old Testament was more likely to end fluidity than fixity in the material transmitted. A fluidity in which event and meaning, ipsissima verba and their interpretation would tend to merge. So D.W. Davies is saying, look, we've got to find some kind of ground here in the middle. Jeremias of Germany and also C.H. Dodd of England have also wrestled with some form of middle ground between these two extremes. C.H. Dodd, in his last great work, Founder of Christianity, makes the following statement. When all allowance has been made for limited factors, the changes of oral transmission, the effect of translation, the interest of teachers in making the same sayings contemporary, and simple human fallibility, it remains that the first three Gospels offer a body of sayings on the whole so consistent, so coherent, and withal so distinctive in manner, style, and content, that no reasonable critic should doubt that we have here the sayings of a single, unique teacher. Okay, now we can sort of summarize these three views with an illustration. There's a spring at the top of the mountain, and Wolfmann says the water from the, there is a spring, water does come out of that spring, the water seeps into the ground. And so down at the bottom of the mountain, there is water seeping out of the ground, and the villagers drinking this water think, never having climbed the mountain, that it probably comes from the spring. Wolfmann says it doesn't, but it's irrelevant, who cares? Good water, drink it anyway. The Scandinavians say, no way. At the spring at the very top, there's a concrete catchment pool, and there's a pipe. And the pipe comes all the way down the mountain, and you drink it at the bottom, and it is pure water right out of the spring, and there is no mixing with the ferns and the soils and all the rest of it on the way down. C.H. Dodd and Jeremias say, no, there isn't any catchment pool, and there's no pipe. But when we find the various rivulets at the bottom, put them through a sieve, and then test the water, and you'll find it's got all the same content, it's the same tasting water, and so the only reasonable conclusion is it all comes from the same source. However, neither Jeremias nor Dodd nor D.W. Davies give us any methodology as to how it comes down the mountain. You say, well, we don't know how it got down the mountain. All you can do is sift it, and then you find that, well, it's got bits and pieces of all kinds of things. And yes, but you can carefully sort those out, and you can get good spring water, and you can assume that it comes from the same spring. Now, what we're going to look at now is there a framework growing out of Middle Eastern life for a median view between what technically can be called radical historicizing, namely that there were tape recorders and took it all down, or radical kerygmatizing, which would be these people simply wrote theological plays about Jesus, and they had no idea what he said or did, and never mind because the theological plays are great stuff, and that's really all you need for the Christian faith. Is there any way in which we can find our way between radical historicizing and radical kerygmatizing? The difficulty, I think, is that the radical historicizing people have not given us an adequate answer as to why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are different. The radical kerygmatizing boys have not given us an adequate answer as to why Matthew, Mark, and Luke are so much the same. And so we have to find our way between these two radical views. Now, first of all, let us notice in our Middle Eastern world that both forms of passing on of information are still alive. The form of the rumor transmission, the informal, uncontrolled oral tradition, which in a few years the stuff is so garbled you got nothing left. This is preserved for jokes and atrocity stories. You know, we have three people blown up in front of a bakery in Beirut, and within a week you've got a story of a 300 people massacred. And massacred, of course, by your political enemies, whoever they happen to be. And a couple of weeks later, the whole story is gone, or a month later, the whole story is gone. That methodology is there in any community, particularly a community in conflict, and this we can call a natural human failure. On the other hand, the formal control oral tradition is also very much among us. If you want to be a teacher of religion in the Muslim faith, you go to Al-Azhar in Cairo, and the entrance requirements to memorize the Quran. That's only, you know, three-fourths the length of the Old Testament. That's not too long. And as soon as you've learned that, you can matriculate. You don't have to know anything else. Now they've changed the rules. You've got to get some education. But up until the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser, for 1,000 years, that was the only entry requirement. And if you were bright enough to learn it by the time you were 8, you could get in at 8, as did Taha Hussein, a very famous Egyptian blind student who ended up minister of education. He described in a book called Stream of Days his memorizing the Quran as a young boy, and while he was still at his 12 years old, he went off to the Azhar. The first thing you memorize after memorizing the Quran is to memorize Al-Bayt Abu Malik. This is a thousand couplets of classical Arabic poetry, and every couplet has within it one rule of Arabic grammar. And so you learn your Arabic grammar by memorizing this 1,000 couplet poem. I studied under a Sheikh Sayyid, who had both, at the age of 75, had both of these documents that instantly recall the back of his mind. So I would come with a little piece of Arabic poetry and I would ask him, Sheikh Sayyid, is this from the Quran? He would, no. That's how long it took him to flip through the entire Quran. About computers. I mean, this computer had nothing on him. Whenever I'd ask him anything about grammar, he would pull out one of those 1,000 couplets and quote it to me. Now, of course, I didn't know any more after he got done. Because the Arabic was of the Middle Ages, so classical, it would be like quoting Chaucer to me. You know, I said, I couldn't follow, but then he would explain it. But the stuff was all there on instant recall. So that's the Muslim community. In the Christian community, the long, massive liturgies of the Christian church are still preserved and passed on orally. For example, in the 2nd century, there was in the Syriac community a very famous Syriac father who unfortunately was a heretic. His name was Baldassan, and he didn't write books like Jesus. He knew if you want to get heard across the community, you'd better tell stories and recite poems. So he recited poems. He put all of his stuff into 7-syllable per line poems, and the stuff moved all across the Syriac community, unfortunately for the heretic. So a couple of hundred years later, long after he was dead, the great scholar and saint of the Syriac church, Ephraim the Syrian, wanted to do something about this. Now there's no point in writing a book because the people aren't going to read it. So he decided you can only fight fire with fire, so he decided he was going to begin to compose his stuff in seven syllable per line meter. It's called It Wasn't So Bad, which he did, and he poured his poetry, as it were, into the same lake, and the color of his poems, which were also very good, in fact, better than Blood of the Sand, he managed Blood of the Sand was gradually forgotten, and Ephraim the Syrian won. Now, in this battle of the giants, stretching over a 200-year period, not a single piece of paper was involved. So you can come with me to Achan, which is the Syriac Orthodox monastery, seminary. They bring young guys in their early teens up there. They give them 6 months. And after 6 months, they have to quit talking Arabic, and they have to begin to talk 5th century Syriac. So, you know, pass the butter comes out in what would be for us Chaucerian English. And they talk to themselves 5th century Syriac. Whenever they have visitors, they bring in the seminary, and the seminary starts singing the 7-syllable per meter chants of Ephraim the Syrian, and they'll go on by the hour. There are no books. They have no published papers. And here they are. They are reciting the stuff composed orally by St. Ephraim the Syrian in the 5th century. Now, both of those methodologies are thereby very, very much among us. However, there is also a third methodology in our Middle Eastern world that has all the signs of great antiquity and that, to my knowledge, has never been examined. To my knowledge, the scholarly world is not aware of it and is, I think, the more appropriate framework within which to understand the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth and the way in which that material is passed on and preserved for us in the New Testament. This I have called informal control or tradition. Now, if you will please, I've borrowed one word from each side. Volmanians say it's informal uncontrolled. I've got the word informal from them. And the Scandinavians say it's formal control. And I've got the word control for them. And I've lined up one word from each side in the middle, which I think is where the action really is. Now, what we're going to look at is, first of all, look at the setting within which this functions, then at the kinds of material retained, the nature of the people who do the reciting, the controls exercised by the community, the techniques for introducing new material, and then we will reflect briefly on the significance of this type of oral tradition for the synoptic tradition of our Lord in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We are not, I would warn you, trying to solve the synoptic problem, but rather we are trying to introduce a new data which we feel is more appropriate for the solving of many of the critical problems that are framed out of which we can understand the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, what happens in our Middle Eastern village before they got television, electricity and television, which is going to probably blow this methodology right off the map, given a couple of generations, although it will last quite a while, because it's very deeply rooted in our Middle Eastern world. People sit around at night, and they engage in what they call hafalat samai. Samai is an Arabic word which culminates with the Hebrew shamara, which means to preserve. These are parties for preservation, literally. What is it that they are preserving? They are preserving the tradition of the community, and particularly the tradition that relates to their own identity. And they're doing it in a community setting. Now, what happens? Okay, the people come together. Usually the elders are seated on benches, the young people usually on the floor, the adults would be on the floor, then usually in the next room, and the round of stories and poems begins to be told. Who does the reciting? It's the people who are probably the brightest, because they remember the most, and also the people who are socially more common. There are no official teachers, no one is officially designated as a teacher, no official students, and so that's why I call it informal. The material is passed on in this informal setting. People have always tried to figure out something about a formal setting. People have talked about, yes, the Bedouins have people who go from campfire to campfire that are officially designated as storytellers. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not an expert in Bedouin culture, but I do know from my own 30 years of experience in the Middle East exactly You have to have grown up in that village. I remember one village, and I was asking one in a certain Hapless Summit, I was asking what looked to be the oldest man seated there, he was almost 60, about some of the traditions of the village, and he sort of kind of hesitantly made a few remarks. And then other people said, you can't ask him, he wouldn't understand. I said, well, what do you mean he wouldn't understand? Well, he's not in this village. Well, how long has he lived here? Oh, he's only lived here 37 years. I mean, that's not long enough for him to know what goes on in this village. So you see, there are limits as to who is allowed to do the reciting. You have to be a part of the 1,000-year-old heritage of that village before you're allowed to recite its materials. Okay, now, what are the kinds of things that are recited in these Hapalat Sama, these parties for preservation? First of all, are proverbs. Every culture has some of them. A stitch in time saves none. Okay, every culture has some of these. In the Middle East, there are literally thousands of these. And you see an uneducated, illiterate construction worker in the streets of Beirut who sleeps in the street, he's that poor, and he's got 1,500 to 2,000 proverbs floating around in the back of his head. If he grew up in a community where night after night after night these parties for preservation were taking place, and he can't sit down and write them out, but when things come up, it will trigger his memory and undoubtedly they will come. I have a friend in the south of Egypt who has collected 2,500 of these from the Egyptian scene. There is a German scholar in the 19th century who published 3 volumes of them. There is a Lebanese scholar, his name is Anis Blanca, published 2 volumes of them in Lebanon. Second are story riddles. Now these are not brain twisters like we have, where you ask the person to see if you can figure this out. They are the wise man, the great man, is put in a corner in a situation from which there is no escape, no solution, and he comes up with a very wise answer that amazes everyone. This is like the story of Solomon and the two women and the one baby. This would be a story riddle. Or it's like Jesus and the woman taken in adultery. He's trapped, he's caught, there's no escape. Jesus, with the wise answer, solves the problem. A third type is poetry. Okay, poems of the Middle East are of two kinds. The poems are preserved, again, very, very carefully, very tightly, because the meter itself preserves it. There are either classical poems, and these sometimes were passed on for hundreds of years, both in Christian and in Muslim circles, orally, finally written down. In Islam, there's a whole collection of poetry called the Shahr-e-Jahili, the poetry of the time of ignorance, which they mean before the revelation of the Quran. And that stuff wasn't written down for 300-400 years. There is also great fat volumes of Arabic Christian poetry in the same way, passed on for a long, long time before it was written down. We assume probably that some of the prophets of the Old Testament, like Amos, or maybe the same thing may be true. But there's another kind of poetry. This is called Zajab. And this is for people who have no education, maybe they can't even read and write. And the Zajabi, the man who can recite this stuff, is somebody who can make up little rhymes for any occasion. You always try and bring a Zajabi to a wedding, because he'll stand up on the table in the midst of the wedding banquet and he'll start reciting the stuff, and he will comment on what has happened in that wedding. It all comes out first. It just blows my mind every time I see these fellows functioning. And you get two of them and they will respond to another. I make up one stanza and then the other Zajabi makes up a stanza. And we have a Maronite monk, for example, who composed an entire history of the Maronite church in Zajab, and it was carried on in the tradition for over 200 years before it was finally written down. All right, now the fourth type is, the first type you mentioned is the proverbs, the second are the story riddles, the third is the poetry, the fourth is the parable or story. Good stories, either to entertain or to edify. Once there was a rich man who, once there was a priest who, once a soldier who, and so on. And these are well-told stories, as well-told stories surface in any society. The fifth are stories about the people who founded the community. Historical events about the one whose life and sayings form the identity of the community. How was this village founded? Those stories are very carefully preserved. For example, in the village of Delopennis, in the south of Egypt, the Christian villagers will say, and these are always told in the present tense, when the Romans came, we escaped to the mountains and hid in the caves. Our men sneaked down the river at night to bring us water. We did this to escape the Roman persecution. Now, I know the Roman persecution stopped in the early 4th century. These people don't know that. All they say is, men's a man, long time ago. And they are, in fact, telling stories of probably the 3rd or 4th, early 4th century. And they're still telling those stories, and they are telling them as though it happened to them. I can remember in 1959 going with a group of Egyptian pastors to visit a Orthodox bishop of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church on the top of a mountain in Eritrea. We went there, had this marvelous conversation. Fortunately, our taxi driver knew both Tigri, which is what he spoke, and Arabic, which is what we spoke. I was the only Westerner in the group. And in the middle of the conversation, this was 1959, the bishop said, "We felt very badly when you were overrun." Okay. 1956, 3 years before, the Israelis had overrun the Egyptian army and taken all of the Sinai Desert. That's what he's talking about. We felt very badly when you were overrun. And the conversation went on and didn't quite fit. So I leaned over to the fellow next to me and said, when he made that phrase about we felt very badly when you were overrun, he was, of course, talking about the Israeli attack on Egypt 3 years ago. Oh, no, 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 no. He was talking about the Muslim invasion in 640. I was the only guy in the middle. We felt very badly when you were overrun. I mean, you know, doesn't everybody use that language to talk about something that happened in the 7th century? Right, this is the world out of which we're now talking. This tremendous sense of the importance of history, particularly that history which forms your identity. And the stories about it are very carefully controlled. Fine. Now, we've seen the 5 different types of material that are preserved. Let's talk now about the nature of the controls. Now, Nielsen, in their book, talks about Gunkel's recollection of the storytelling of the grandfather in the German home passing on German folktale. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about someone who, in a formal setting of a community gathering, tells the stories of the tradition. There are other patriarchs in the room. It's a very serious thing that's taking place. If the material is recited imperfectly, it will be corrected. Nobody's going to correct the German grammar. But he will be corrected. Some will say, oh, not right. And so the person who recites the material is very careful to recite correctly, lest he be shamed by having someone tell him, you didn't tell it right. And this is the nature of the controls, and it's always the seated community that does it. I remember reflecting, I've been working on this for 25 years, and this is the first time I've managed to get it down in any systematic fashion on paper. And at one point in my research on the question, I was talking to a graduate student who is doing work on the life of George Washington, the first American president. And this student said that he was doing PhD studies in Washington. He said, Ken, you've got much better data than I do. You've got better data about Jesus of Nazareth than I have about George Washington. I said, what do you mean? He said, all I have are the journals of the people who worked with him. And there was no community control. I have no idea whether these conversations, whether these events that are described in these journals actually took place, because the man, years afterwards, is writing them down, and there's no one around to say, hey, that ain't the way it happened. But you have community control. You can be more confident of the authenticity of what you're talking about with Jesus of Nazareth than I can about George Washington. I found this very amazing. Mind you, in the Middle East, we have a shame-pride culture. The child is not raised with the idea of loyalty to an abstract principle. The mother doesn't say to the kid, that's wrong, Johnny. The mother says to the kid, hey, shame on you. Which means you are to do those things which stimulate in you pride, and you are to avoid those things which which stimulate in your own soul shame, and this is to control the things you're supposed to do and the things you're not supposed to do. Every culture's got some of that. The Middle East has a great deal of it. So the idea of telling a story in public and being corrected by other patriarchs of other major families in the village is so humiliating, you're going to be very, very careful you don't do it. Now, the first level is no flexibility. These are the poems and the proverbs. No flexibility. Zero. If you're not quite sure about the poem, you will say, and someone will pick it up and recite it for you. The second level is the level in which there is some flexibility. This is the stories, the parables, and the recollection of historical events important to the identity of the community. Here, you are able to tell the story in your own way with a certain flexibility within limits. Okay, now we've got to have an illustration, and of course now we're talking about oral tradition, and it's going to be sacrilege for me to read this. It's all written out here. To my knowledge, this is the first time it's ever been written out in probably 1,000 years, but I can't read it to you. I have to recite. One time in a couple of summer, somebody said, "Well, the Shen won't come." Shen was pleased to accept cover. I sounded like a punchline. And so I said, "What's this all about?" So the people sort of looked around, and they spotted the most distinguished patriarch in the circle, and they said, "Reverend Dad knows the story." Of course, they all could, but they let him tell the newcomer what the story was all about. And the story was as follows. The noble Shen decided that it was time for him to find a wife. So he saddled up his horse and began his journey in the wide, wide world to find a wife appropriate to his nobility. Soon there was a companion who was also riding along. They were riding along together, and as the day passed, Shen said to him, "Are you going to carry me, or am I going to carry you?" And the other companion said, "Don't be ridiculous. We're riding horses. We can't carry each other." And the Shen fell silent. Late afternoon, they approached the village of the traveler, the companion, and Shen said, "This green wheat field that we are passing, is it eaten or is it not eaten?" And the other man said, "Well, no, don't be ridiculous. It's not even right. How could it be?" Shen didn't answer. As they entered the village, there was a funeral procession came out, and Shen said, "Is the man in the box dead or alive?" And the companion said, "Look, they're burying him, dum-dum. What is he? Well, of course he's dead." And so as they entered the village, the companion, of course, invited Shen for the night. They got into the house. The companion went to the back of the house to his daughter, whose name was Tabaha, and said, "You have to prepare a meal. I have a guest, but he's a very stupid fellow." "Why do you say he's a stupid fellow?" And he recited the events of the day. She said, "Oh, my father, I have always respected you and always been taught never to disagree with your opinions, but you have insulted a very intelligent man. How is that?" Well, when he asked her, "Are you going to carry me along or shall I carry you along?" He wanted what he was saying was, "Are you going to tell a story and carry us along and pass the time, or shall I tell a story and carry you along?" And when he asked about the wheat field, he wanted to know whether the village moneylender had already eaten this poor fellow's wheat by giving him so in debt that he would never be able to pay. And we all know the proverb which says, "He who has a son dies not." And so he wanted to know whether the poor fellow had a son, and thereby his name is perpetuated in the village, or whether he didn't have a son, and thereby his name is cut off. "And so you've insulted a very intelligent man." The companion rushed out and apologized to Shen. Shen said, "Well, I accept your apology, but how did you discover this?" "Well, my daughter explained this all to me." "Oh, may I see him?" "Of course." The daughter is brought out. Shen was pleased to accept help. Okay. I heard that story about 20 years ago, and a couple of years ago, I dredged it up out of my memory, and we had a class of Lebanese, Palestinians, Syrians, Jordanians, and Egyptians. The Egyptians were too far away, not heard it, but the students from the other four countries, four countries, mind you, had never read it, they'd all heard it, only orally. I asked them, "Did I tell it correctly?" They said, "Yes." Then we began to examine what would I have done that would have triggered the rejection mechanism. How much liberty did I have? Well, you can't change the punchline, you can't change the wording of the parable which occurs at the end. The three scenes are essential. You can rearrange the order of the scenes. That doesn't matter. You can get Shem very, very upset. You can get the companion very, very upset or not so upset. You can make up the dialogue between Shem and his daughter. There's a lot you can fiddle with, but the basic thrust of the story cannot be changed. If you fiddle with the basic thrust of the story, you're going to be in trouble, and someone will say, hey, you have that right. So here was an oral tradition that was passed on in all of these various communities. They all knew it, and they knew it as an ancient story, and there was a centrality of the thrust of the story along with the freedom of individual interpretation of it. Now here we have continuity and flexibility. If you're taking notes, please put those two words down. Continuity and flexibility. Not continuity and change. Now what's the difference? Continuity and change would be you can change any 20% of the story you like. So by the time you've gone through five different transmissions, the whole story is gone. You've played the story, you've probably played the game of somebody tells some horrendous story to somebody at one end, and then the thing is repeated all the way through, and then you give somebody at the end, and then the last person stands up and tells what they heard. All right, there's continuity and change, but any bit of it can change. Any 20%, you get that, you've got that. But continuity and flexibility means that you have the possibility of fiddling with the bits and pieces around the edge, but the central thrust cannot be touched at all. And so the letter A doesn't move to B, and then to C, and then to D, and then to E. The A remains the same, but it can be colored red, or black, or blue, as you so choose. Now, C.S. Lewis, in his introduction to the writings of George MacDonald, talks about great stories. He says the thing that really nourishes my mind is the series of events which that great story captures. I can hear it told this way or that way or some other way. That is what really enriches me. It's the series of events in that story that do so. Or as he says, he points out that a great story consists of a particular pattern of events. That pattern of events nourishes and delights the listener, not a particular set of words. He grants that if the communication is writing, it's nice that it should be fairly written. Okay, now, but what about the historical? We've talked about the story, which has a certain flexibility. What about the story? What about the historical narrative? Okay, let me tell you two historical narratives, one from the ancient past and one from the more recent past. In one of the villages in the south of Egypt, you go to the village and ask them about the founding of the village, and they will say, well, right next door to us here is the city of Antonopolis, which was built, I happen to know, by Hadrian at the middle of the 2nd century. Then they say when the monks came along, they built a monastery right at the edge of this pagan city. They began making palm leaf baskets as a way to support the monastery, and instead of two handles, they put three handles on them. They went to the marketplace, began selling the baskets. The baskets were very good quality and very good price, and so all these pagans began buying their baskets, and in the buying of the baskets, they said, look, most good basket, but this is really very funny. We've got two handles, but what's the third one for? And the monks say, well, that has to do with what we believe. Oh, really? What is it you believe? Well, we believe that ultimate reality is one, and yet it is three. Ah, well, what is this ultimate reality? So pretty soon you've got a discussion of the Trinity and the deity of Christ, and goodness knows what, and this is all in the marketplace over the selling of the basket. And so the monks, by the way in which they sustained themselves economically, they developed a starting point for evangelism. Now, in the village that was given birth to by those monks, there is no way in which you're going to foul up that story. If you foul up that story, they'll kick you out of the village. A certain freedom to tell it, yes, but within limits, because what happened in that story is critical for their own individual, for their own community identity. Okay, so in summary, stories, parables, and historical narratives have continuity and flexibility in their recitation. Now, the third category of the Haflet Summa is the jokes, the casual news of the day, the stories of intercommunal atrocities, and within this there are no controls. It does not enter the tradition. The stories are not repeated over a long time. They quickly fade and are very quickly forgotten. Okay, now so far we've talked only about old material. What about new material? How does the stuff, is there anything that we can look at that will help us understand how this particular type of tradition functions? Yes. In the 19th century, there was a famous Scottish missionary who went to Egypt. His name was John Hogg. He was the founder of the Egyptian Evangelical Church. He died of the burst of appendicitis in 1886, and 28 years later, his daughter wrote a book about his life. When she wrote a book about his life, she had his papers, but she also went around to the villages where he had taught and lived and picked up the oral tradition about him, and the book is half oral tradition, half written sources. Only 28 years after his death, let the reader understand. Only 28 years. In our Middle Eastern world, 28 years is nothing. When you're talking about remembering the stories of the founder of the community, this is nothing. Okay, so she picked up out of this oral tradition stuff which I also heard in 1960. And the stories were basically the same, because the oral tradition went on, even after they didn't even know she'd written it down, and they couldn't have cared less. If these people want to write this stuff down in English, well, we don't care. If these people want to write it down in Greek, we can speak Aramaic. It's no interest to us. We have the oral tradition which goes on. I find a very close parallel here, worth 10. Okay, so one of the stories is that he went to a particular village. This village, there was a mayor who was a very, very nasty fellow, and he sent one of the guards up. He was preaching in the street, sent a guard up on the top of the house to urinate on him. And so Dr. Hogg stepped aside, took his handkerchief out, wiped his face off, and went on preaching, didn't even look up. And the mayor was so stunned by anybody that had the presence of mind to do this. After the sermon, he said, "I want to talk to you." And after inquiry, he said, "I don't know where you got this, but anyone with that kind of character is what I need and what our village needs, and please tell me how you came to be the kind of a man you were." And by the end of the conversation and instruction, he became a Christian and became a leader of the community. In another village called Methleton Milk, he was entertained in a home of a very, very obstreperous villager who said, "Dr. Hogg, you believe in the gospel?" "Yes." "Well, it says that whenever the evangelist goes from village to village, he's supposed to eat what's put before him. Do you believe that?" "Yes." And then they brought him a cow turd on a plate. Drowned cow turd. Said, "Eat it." And he answered, "Da ate na, dini ate basha wa kulna." "This is food for the fire. Bring me food for people and I will eat it." Now I am 1,000% sure that I am now quoting to you the ipsissima verba. These are the words he spoke 100 years ago. Why? Because those people remembered it, and those people told it to me. All right, now there were another village he went to. The children, he was on a houseboat, and the children thought they'd make fun of this funny-looking Scotchman, and so they, every time he'd get down off his houseboat to go into the village to preach, they would stand there and they would sing a chant song. "Mr. John Hogg is so tall, crack his head and see him fall." He got very tired of this, and so he bought a large sack of hard candy, and every time he would come or go, they would sing this. And he'd say, "Oh, that's really a nice song. You've written a song about me. I really enjoy it." So they would sing it, and he would say, "Thank you very much," and he would give all the singers a piece of hard candy. This went on for about 4 days, till finally the sack of hard candy was over. So the kids sang the song, he thanked them, and then they waited for their hard candy. There wasn't any. And they said, "Well, where's our candy?" He said, "Well, I don't have any more." "Well, if you're not going to give us any candy, we're not going to come here and sing your song." Son of one of the singers told me the story. complete with tongues. The incident, I think, happened about 1870, and I heard it 100 years later. Okay, the founder was the founder of the community. Stories of what he said and did, particularly in the context of conflict, where he came out with a very wise answer, were the things the community remembered. Oh God, our time is running out. These stories are so good. I've got a dozen villages. There's another village in which he went. There was a small, nominally Christian community, and most of the village was Muslim. The mayor was Muslim. The mayor's brother died. Big funeral tent was put up. He went to the funeral tent to offer condolences. A troublemaker stood up and said, Dr. Hall, yes, this iron guy, did he go to the fire or to the garden? Muslim words for heaven and hell. See, if John Hogg says he went to the fire, the mayor's going to throw him out of the village. If he says he went to the guards, he went to heaven, the Christians in the village are never going to listen to John Hogg preach again. So, they'll show you where he said it when you go to the village. They said he went like this, and we knew he was praying. We knew he was praying. And then he said, Mr. Mayor, yes, this Ayub guy, was he a follower of Muhammad, or a follower of Moses, or a follower of Jesus, or a follower of Muhammad? The Christian way of saying, was he a Muslim, Christian, or a Jew? And the mayor said, no, he was a follower of Muhammad. Ah, said John Hall, you ask me, where is he? He is with Muhammad.
Absolutely unforgivable when we get done.
Okay, What about a historical event? Here, I want to tell one story of a wedding in the south of Egypt that happened to end up in tragedy. I'd been out of the village when it happened. I came back 2 weeks later, and the boatman who took me across the Nile said, "Did you hear the vista? Have you heard the story?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you know, the wedding, yes, okay. They have weddings in the villages. They always fire their guns off into the air, hundreds of rounds, big wedding, thousands of rounds. The guns are old. The ammunition is quite sometimes right up to the roof of the church. We try and stop that. But the ammunition is quite often very stale, and sometimes there are accidents, as happened in this case. The fellow fired the gun, didn't go off. He lowered it, and it delayed just enough, and it fired when it right at the stomach of the groom, and the man died. So the story is told now to me, Hannah fired the gun did not go off, he lowered the gun fired, happened. Boutros died, he didn't cry out, "Oh my father," nor "Oh my mother," meaning he died without crying out. When the police came, we told them, "A camel stepped on me." I got into the boat, crossed the river, there was a little boy waiting for me, and he wanted to tell the story. Fine, I listened to it again. He gave a little boy's version, but when he got to the center of the story, he told it exactly the same way. Then the guards around the mayor's house, the mayor, the pastor, everybody told it the same way. So here was I had one about 2 hour period, a sociological testing of all the various sociological layers of the village, and everybody from the little kid up to the mayor were all telling the story the same way when they got to the central thrust of the story. With the help of the pastor, we did some analysis. The analysis was, okay, the critical thing is, was this an act of God, or is it an act of murder? If it's an act of murder, then the family of the dead boy has to kill the killer. If it's an act of God, then there can be payment of money and the whole thing's all over. After 3 days of very intense debate, both families were satisfied that this was an act of God, so the way they tell it is passive. Hannah fired the gun, he lowered the gun, good evening, the gun fired, passing. It's an act of God, not an act of man. And so the police got, we told them, "Camel stepped on," which means we're saying to the police, "Please stay out of this. It's all settled. It was an accident, and you don't have to interfere." The police know exactly what is being said to them. There is no misrepresentation of fact when they're told the camel stepped on. By the way, informally, they know exactly what happened anyway, but nobody's going to sign a piece of paper, because if they can ask any one of the 5,000 people in that village, they'll come out the same way. Do you want to meet ya? Man, my gosh, what are you, 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 it's going to be exactly the same phrases and almost the same words. That was 26 years ago, and I can still say it. The event is condensed into, you can tell a lot of it the way you like, but there is a central thread through the middle that is going to remain the same. Because these were not the most important families in the village, that story will not be told probably more than a generation. But they did condense it in a way in which everybody's telling it the same way. Alright, now, so thereby, the fixed form is set and can last a long time. Alright, where are we? The last one is in worship. Whenever I would in preaching to an oral tradition community in the Middle East, I find that whenever I tell a story that they like, all of a sudden the congregation breaks up. And they're all talking to one another. When this first happened, it used to, you know, what's going on? Where my Presbyterian Calvinistic sense of decency and order is being violated. And it all happened. And then I discovered that they were engaged in oral shorthand. Because the elders sitting on the front row, the important people always sit on the front row, you can read their names to find that out. And he calls out to one of his friends at the back and says, "Hey, did you hear what that preacher said? He said," and then he repeats the punchline. And everybody was repeating the punchline 2 or 3 times to the people around them because they wanted to memorize it before they let the preacher go on. They did. They're going to retell that story for now 5 years. Too good a story to let go. And there aren't that many, too many people who come in and give them a new story to be recited in the storytelling sessions at night. They're a good one. And we have to stop him until everybody says it 4 or 5 times to their neighbors. It was an oral shorthand. That's what was happening. Okay, all of these things are happening. Now, the passage that we read this morning, what does Luke say? He says he got his information from eyewitnesses and ministers of the word. What is this word minister? In Greek, it's huperates. The huperates is a Greek translation of the Hebrew word hazan. The hazan. Hazed is the guy who has the keys to the cupboard. It really means store cupboard keeper. Because amongst his other tasks, he led in worship, he swept the place out, he did the disciplining of the elders if anybody needed to be disciplined, he taught the faith to the children, but amongst his critical tasks was he had the keys to the cupboard. So Saturday morning when worship comes, he unlocks the cupboard by side of everybody, brings the scroll, gives it to the person who's going to read it, and he stands there till the fellow's finished, takes the scroll back and goes and locks it up. This was apparently the most important thing he did because that's where he got his title. He was the Hazed Ishul, the cupboard keeper of the synagogue. Okay, now we have the same word, cupboard keeper, but it's not attached to the word synagogue, it's cupboard keeper of the word. And there's only one definite article in the two words, one definite article in Greek in the two words, which I think is more appropriately grammatically argued that this means that they are the same people. You cannot be one of these special people who is a cupboard keeper of the word unless you happen to be also an eyewitness. Who were they? They were not the average preacher. Luke says, this is where I got my stuff. I got it from these people. Others have written down small documents, and it's from these people and the documents written down from what they had to say, this is where I got my stuff. Who were they? I think they were the watchdogs on the oral tradition. They were the people who had grown up in these villages, heard the Havalat Samar, and they were authorized to repeat it. So before a gospel is written down, Ken Bailey's going to preach. He doesn't have to be an eyewitness, and so he doesn't have the freedom in the community to tell the story. So-and-so is, hey, Joe, will you tell us the story of Jesus? Joe, who is a cupboard keeper of the word, stands up and tells the story, now Ken Bailey will preach. After one generation, you don't need these people because they've got it all written down. Anybody who grew up in those villages up to the time of the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70 would have been an authentic reciter of this informal, controlled oral tradition. After the year 70, with the destruction of Jerusalem, the community was dispersed, and the sociological controls would be gone. But anybody 20 years of age and older would be still an authentic reciter of that tradition. So clear through to the end of the first century, these people are there in the community to pass judgment on the books that the community produces. And they're able to say, this is a fair representation of our Lord. Knowing, you don't have to say it with the exact words, but there must be basic authenticity because he is the founder of the community. And thereby to remember what he said and done, did is important to our understanding of our own identity. And it seems to me that we thereby, with this methodology, discovering still alive, clear into the 20th century in the Middle East, we are not trapped into the radical historicizing, assuming people walked around in state orders, nor are we locked into the radical pragmatizing, say, well, you tell, give me one paragraph of something your grandfather said, you can't do it, nobody can remember stuff orally, it's always corrupted, thereby all we've got is theological dramas, which the early church dreamed up, goodness knows where, attributed to Jesus. Those two options are not our only options. That in the informal, controlled oral tradition, we have authenticity, and at the same time, there is the community granted freedom for individual expression of it, of the kind that we see in the differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And thereby, through such a methodology, we can be assured that Jesus, the theologian, speaks to us with all clarity and with all brilliance and all power. And the Jesus of history is knowable and recoverable. And at the same time, the added measure of insight which comes through the spirit and soul of the evangelist, by God's gift of his spirit, can also enrich our understanding of the meaning of those stories and events. I have gone on too long. I thank you for your attention. The next time we'll try and keep it in the time of prayer.